This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have the really great pleasure of interviewing Michael Feinstein, who's written a book, and just a wonderful book called The Gershwins and Me, subtitled A Personal History in 12 Songs. How are you, Michael?
I'm great. I'm very happy to be speaking with you, David.
Well, it's really a pleasure. I didn't get to listen to the CD that you did that is an accompaniment to the book. Is it the same title?
Yes, it is. The CD was created specifically for the book, and it contains the 12 songs that are the chapter headings of the 12 chapters. So it was created expressly for this project.
Well, just, I guess, you know, sort of a structural question. What made you decide on 12 as the number of chapters to organize the story into?
I don't know. 11 seemed like too little and 13 seemed like too many. It's a very Jewish answer. I don't know. It just was sort of a number that popped out to me as perhaps giving ample opportunity to try and cover, through the guise of the 12 songs, different aspects of the Gershwin brothers' dual careers. The book is created in a sort of patchwork way, in an anecdotal fashion as opposed to linear, and the 12 songs became the linchpins for creating some sort of form for the stories and information.
Well, I think it works. I mean, I wasn't meaning to challenge you on that. It was just sort of an item of curiosity. But I think, you know, clearly it is a nonlinear storytelling. But maybe for people who are listening, we can go back and kind of tell a little bit about how you connected to Ira Gershwin in the first place when you were a very young man. I think you were 20 years old.
Yes.
When you first made contact, but you were already interested in music by then. I mean, this was you were already a musician, I think, by the time you were 20.
It's true. I started playing piano at the age of 5 by ear, and was always interested in and even obsessed with the Great American Songbook, which is what we now call it. I don't know what it was called then. I guess it was just called pop music, popular music. But as I grew older, I continued to play the piano and sing, and became particularly fascinated and even obsessed by the Gershwin songs and George Gershwin's concert works like Rhapsody in Blue and An American in Paris and the Concerto in F. And by the time I was 20 years old, I had a pretty thorough knowledge of the Gershwin oeuvre, as they say. I had tracked down every book and magazine and record I could find, and it was as if I was subconsciously preparing myself to meet Ira Gershwin, which is what happened when I was 20. It was shortly after a move to Los Angeles. I had gone into a record store in Hollywood, a used record store, looking for some out-of-print issues of recordings made by Oscar Levant, who was the great Gershwin interpreter and the man who championed the music of George Gershwin after George Gershwin's untimely death at the age of 38 in 1937. And this man in this record store said, "Oh, well, we have some private records that belong to Oscar, but I don't know if you'd be interested in those." I said, "Can I see them?" And he showed me these records that indeed were an amazing cache of rare Levant recordings, including Gershwin performances that went back to 1934. And so I found out these records had come from the estate of Oscar Levant. And then I somehow finagled the phone number of Oscar Levant's widow, as he had died 5 years earlier. And I met her over the phone, and she invited me over because she was intrigued that this young kid knew so much about her husband. And eventually she created an introduction to Ira Gershwin, who was 80 years old and sedentary and isolated, and it was an impossible thing that happened. But suddenly I was welcomed into the Gershwin home and hired to start cataloging their memorabilia.
Well, you were amazingly lucky when that happened, because, you know, it's sort of one of those turns of events. It's hard to understand, you know, sometimes how things happen. I, as you said, I don't think necessarily out of complete coincidence, but it was like you were drawn to this. I mean, because you were an obsessive collector and interested in the material in the first place, and probably had a certain amount of kind of youthful brio and panache, you were able to find yourself among these people that you really were meant to be with.
It seems that way. It seems that way. In retrospect, I don't see how I could not have met Ira because of the trajectory that my life has taken. It seems like it was just supposed to happen that way. And so I do believe that there was some sort of divine experience that led me to him. I know it sounds maybe egocentric or lofty, but I just can't imagine that I wouldn't have met him.
And so how many years, and you ended up working for him essentially as an assistant, kind of a do-everything person, organizing his stuff and, you know, helping him. But was he, at the time you made contact with him, how old was Ira?
Ira was 80, I was 20, and I spent 6 years and 1 month with him until his death in the summer of 1983.
And his wife, Lee, who, I mean, she lived longer than he did. Did you keep in touch with her afterwards?
After Ira died, about 3 months later, Lee and I had a falling out, and she angrily fired me and told me to get out of the house, that sort of thing. And we did not speak for several years, but eventually, after I had appeared on a television show talking about Ira's work, it was quite surprising to me to get a telegram from her thanking me for all I had done for Ira, and reestablishing contact. And from that point, after I went to see her, we remained very close to the end. So I was very grateful to have a rapprochement with her.
So a lot of the things you talk at the beginning of the book, I mean, even though the book is not linear, a lot of the beginning of the book is about the early years of George and Ira, you know, this great period when they were involved, you know, with the likes of Irving Berlin and Irving Caesar. And, you know, I love this finding out that George and Fred Astaire became friendly in the, I think, 1914, 1916 era. You know, they were involved in this great, well, actually a little later, but they were involved in this great period of New York development of kind of pop music, popular music, Tin Pan Alley, that whole era. They were right in it along with a lot of other people. And you did, I thought it was a great kind of introduction to them in that era, you know, in their early years as being young, you know, young Jewish, part of that whole scene. It was really interesting.
Oh, thank you. It was a very exciting time for America and for American music and creativity, and the excitement of that era is still so palpable when you go back and look at it.
No, it is. I think, you know, well, of course it is for me. I know I have more of a connection to it than a lot of people. And you do talk about this a lot in the book, you know, this, your sense that this music needs to be better known, isn't fully kind of isn't really part of mainstream American culture anymore, and you know, risks being lost in some ways. But you know, I understand your feeling about that, but I do think that you know, like you said at one point, I just sort of dipped into the book a minute ago, and you were worried that you know, so I think it was Oscar Levant said that if you thought of, maybe it was somebody else, if you thought of the 20th century, you'd think of George Gershwin. And you said you're afraid that today people don't.
Yes, and, yeah, it's true. It's true.
And I think that in a way it may be true that people don't know, they may not recognize George Gershwin's name, or they may not know Jerome Kern or some of the other names that were, or Cole Porter even, that, but they know the music. I think the music has, you know, it's a funny thing about music in America, maybe it's in the world, that almost everything is still available to us. You know, as the, you know, in the, now in the early 21st century, nothing, even though things are more popular, you know, like we run a sort of fad world where some style of music will be popular for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, but the old music in a way never goes away. And it always informs the present in some subtle way, so that if you played a piece of Porgy and Bess, I think the chances are good that a large number of people today would actually recognize the tune, may not know who it is, but the music is there.
I would agree with that. I think that certainly people know Summertime, and they know a lot of the work of Gershwin's because it's so much a part of the fabric of our culture. Yet they might not know much more than that. But it is insidious in the sense that there is a continuum, and I think that every contemporary artist alive today, whether they know it or not, has been influenced by Gershwin. And it's because of that connection that I hope that people will be interested in the book, which I tried to create in a way that was welcoming for people that don't know anything about the Gershwins, because I had to create it from the assumption that perhaps most people won't know who they are today.
No, I think you're right. And I loved the way that you made the book both it's both written and visual. You know, for people who are listening, it's a very large book, roughly 9x12, heavy paper, full color throughout, with just incredible illustrations, some of them original art from the 19-teens, 20s, 30s. There's pieces, sheet music, there are playbills, but you've also reproduced a lot of original material, like letters from Gershwin or letters to Gershwin, incredible family photographs that are just, it's impossible to look at this book and not feel drawn into that world. I admit, again, if you're, a lot of people are maybe not interested in 20th century anything, but if you have any interest in the past as it pertains to the present, it's just incredible. I love the self-portrait of Gershwin, and that's a whole other thing that I really think you you introduced me to the idea of Gershwin as a painter, which I probably had known of, but just never penetrated until I saw all of the actual art that you have here.
He was he could have been a professional artist. I mean, he could have been a painter. It's amazing. Irving Berlin also painted, and the paintings are terrible.
I was going to say he painted, but he was not a painter. Gershwin was. I think you also. I mean, you do get the feeling from this that Gershwin was just a genius, an artistic genius, in so many ways that he could. I mean, and you talked about this, that he was a better piano player than, and I hadn't thought about so many of these great composers were themselves not great pianists. That was amazing to learn, and that Gershwin was himself a spectacularly great pianist, able to improvise and change and, just do almost anything. He sounds like a prodigy of some measure.
He was quite amazing. He was dazzling at the piano, and Groucho Marx told a story about how he was very good friends with George, and he wanted to ensure that George would come and play the piano at his party, even though most of the time George did. And if you got George Gershwin to play at your party, it was the greatest thing that could happen. And he would sit down at the piano, he would play for 6 hours, and everybody loved it, except maybe other songwriters who were there. And so Groucho, being very canny, he invited a whole bunch of people to the party but didn't invite George. George said, "What's the matter? Are you mad at me, Groucho?" And he said, "Oh, no, George." He said, "It's just that I know that if I invite you to the party, people are going to force you to play the piano, and I don't want to treat you like you're just a piano player, and I don't want you to think that I would ever have you to a party just because they want you to play the piano, so I thought it'd be better not to invite you." So, of course, the next night, George crashed the party and immediately went to the piano and played all night.
Well, that was another thing that comes across, how social and he loved people. He loved to be with people. You mentioned that Oscar Levant virtually lived in his house, or was it with Ira? I'm not sure. But that was another thing I thought, you know, you talked about his family and how close they all were up until somewhere in the 20s, they all lived in a big apartment building together.
Yes, they moved en masse from one residence to another. They had started to way uptown and eventually moved down to 110th Street, then 103rd Street, and they kept moving closer to Broadway. Eventually, George and Ira ended up on the east side having apartments on East 72nd Street across the street from each other, but that was the first time that they'd lived actually in separate buildings through their career.
Right. I mean, that was a thing about being in a family that is very foreign to people today. You know, when we talk about the nature of family, it's broken apart. Maybe it's coming back together again as the economy is not good. You hear about all these kids moving back to live with their parents, but we look at it as something to avoid, whereas they considered it kind of normal that you would, of course, you'd stay with your family.
Oh, yeah.
And they were, you know, I love the stories about Gershwin and, you know, it going to parties and, you know, just being part of that whole, I mean, it's just incredibly social, the 1920s. It's into the 30s, they were, they just loved to be with each other. And it was a great scene with all of those Broadway people. And then later George and Ira went to Hollywood. I thought that was also kind of a part of his life that maybe people don't know as much about. You know, I think when you think of Gershwin, you think of maybe the shows and the most famous ones and the sort of almost the merging of jazz and pop music. But I don't think it's as well known that he spent a lot of time in Hollywood in the 1930s, say 1931 to 1937 when he died there.
Well, he was there. He had two periods in Hollywood, yes, in the early 30s. But the later part, 36 to 37, he wrote three film scores, and from those three film scores came a dozen standards. It was incredible in a very short period of time. And so even though he had worked mainly on Broadway, the work in Hollywood was very fruitful. And oddly enough, at the time the Astaire and Rogers film Shall We Dance was released, critics said that his score wasn't as good as previous scores written by Jerome Kern and Irving Berlin. And now we look back and see that movie alone produced They Can't Take That Away From Me, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, They All Laughed, Slap That Bass. So it's pretty amazing.
Right. It is amazing. Well, and I think maybe you know this better than I do, but is that period of the 30s when Hollywood was attracting so much talent, partially because they had the money. You mentioned how much, you know, I think George and Ira got $50,000 for one and then $70,000 for another. In 1936 dollars, that's a fortune.
And it was the low end compared to what Kern and Berlin were getting. They actually had to settle for that amount.
Because they had, that's because Porgy and Bess had not done well on Broadway.
Exactly. They were considered sort of, George Gershwin became considered a pariah because he had written an opera and they thought, oh, well, this guy, you know, he's not writing songs anymore. So he had to lobby to get a job as a songwriter again after Porgy and Bess.
Right. That's amazing. But of course, still, I mean, that was a lot of money to get paid then. So clearly Hollywood was attracting all of this songwriting talent. Now, did it take it away from Broadway? You know, when Kern and Berlin and Gershwin were in Hollywood, I would assume they weren't in New York able to write shows. Is that correct?
That is true. And most of them went back to Broadway. But the one exception is Harry Warren. Harry Warren came to Hollywood after having success on Broadway with the Laugh Parade starring Ed Wynn and a lot of musical revues, and was tremendously successful and would have gone on to become a Broadway name as well known as Richard Rodgers or Cole Porter, any of them. But Harry got a job in Hollywood and wrote a musical called 42nd Street and spent the rest of his life writing in Hollywood. So he was the one exception who never went back to New York, but all the others would eventually go back.
Right. Well, of course, Gershwin did not go back because he died.
Yeah.
And maybe you could tell the story. It makes me very sad, even reading about. I've read about it before. I should tell you. You mentioned Catherine Weber and her book, The Memory of All That. I interviewed her when that book came out. Which is it's a great book about Kay Swift and her relationship to George Gershwin, and of course other things about Catherine's life. But you know, I've read the story of Gershwin's death in her book and in your book, and it still makes me sad.
Yes, it's such a poignant story when you think that Gershwin was truly at the height of his creativity. He had over the last, what turned out to be the last two, 3 years of his life, headaches. And these headaches were increasing in their power. And psychiatrists said that it was psychological. He went to another doctor that gave him some sort of treatment with topical cocaine that did not help. And ultimately, it turned out that he had a brain tumor, but they didn't discover that until literally a day and a half before he died. In the period he was in Hollywood, the last 9 months of his life, he was complaining about these headaches, which were getting worse and worse, and people were unsympathetic. Irving Berlin said, "There's nothing wrong with George Gershwin that a song hit won't cure," something that haunted him later for having said. And so George was the epitome of youth and vitality and excitement and creativity, and he got a leave of absence from the Goldwyn Studios where he was working. It was a 2-week leave of absence, and the contract says, you know, we release George Gershwin from obligations, and he goes off salary for 2 weeks, which is the time it is expected it will take for him to recover from his illness, and 10 days later he was dead. And so this man, his passing was incomprehensible. And of all the people who were affected, nobody was more devastated than his brother Ira. You know, Ira had seen George's talent from their earliest years. You know, George was his baby brother, 18 months younger, and Ira could not believe that fate would be so cruel to take George. Ira would have gladly given his own life to go in George's place, and he was mad at God. I mean, he literally never prayed or never believed in God after that. I mean, that was so devastating.
Oh, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you did talk about that as well. I think it's clear that for Ira, you know, losing his brother was just something that he would never get over. It's you know, like losing a child almost.
Yeah, it is. It's the sort of thing that Ira internalized, and he spoke endlessly about George. When I worked in the Gershwin home, it was as if George was still there because of the paintings and everything, that all of his belongings. But there were times when it would get too close to the bone for Ira, and he would take to his bed, getting very depressed when it really came back to him in a way that was like he was reliving it.
Well, talk a little bit about Ira. I think because he did have a long career after his brother died, and he, you know, he kept working. You know, he was a pretty amazing lyricist. I mean, that's another thing that is sort of incredible, is that these two brothers, not only were they able to work together, I mean, it's not always true of brothers or siblings of any kind, but, you know, Ira was good. I mean, he was a good lyricist.
He was a wonderful lyricist, and the only person who doesn't seem to feel that is Stephen Sondheim, who referred to him in his book as rhyming poison. But other than Sondheim, most people acknowledge that Ira was one of the greats and could have had a career completely separate from George, even though Ira did not see that. You know, I mean, Ira felt that his success was due to the fact that he was attached to George. Eventually, Ira achieved his own acclaim, and after George died, Ira went on to collaborate first with Kurt Weill, with Jerome Kern, with Aaron Copland, with Burton Lane, with Harold Arlen. And Ira always said that of all the other people he worked with, George was the only one whom he considered truly to be a genius. And so Ira worked, and he thought he did good work with these other writers, but he never felt that he was as inspired as he was with George.
Well, his connection too is—it's almost—it is like a spiritual connection when it's your someone you grew up with. You know, you understand each other in a way that it's impossible to be with anyone else. I can certainly see how he would feel that no one else could work with him in the same way.
Yes, he absolutely compared everybody to George. You know, it was always. You know, Sweeney Todd, when he talked about Sondheim, he said, well, Sondheim didn't orchestrate Sweeney Todd, so it's not really an opera. I mean, everything was compared to George, and nobody could measure up to George in Ira's mind.
So of all of the songs, I mean, and this is a terrible question to ask you. I mean, you've put 12 songs, or actually maybe 12 songs in the book and on the CD. Are these your favorite Gershwin songs, or, and even if you had to, which would be your favorite if you had to pick just one?
The favorite that comes to mind this moment is Isn't It a Pity, which is not one of the 12 songs chosen for the book, and is certainly a favorite of mine. The other one is Love Is Here to Stay, which is everybody's favorite, and it's because it's imbued with a certain kind of poignance or pathos and true inspiration, because Ira wrote that after George's death about George. I mean, the melody existed, but Ira finished it after George died, and I feel that those words are born out of the horrible, tragic loss.
And which of his songs do you really like to perform the best? Can you say which ones you really kind of move you and get into your heart and soul when you sing?
Of Thee I Sing is a song that I love to perform. Someone to Watch Over Me is another one. I've Got a Crush on You, certainly, is one that I love. And the whimsical ones, They All Laughed, that's one that brings me a great deal of pleasure. Embraceable You, there's extra lyrics, and I like pulling out the extra lyrics of these songs. So people may know the songs very well, but then I'll pull out a verse or a couple of lines that are unfamiliar, and it pricks up the ear, as they say.
Right. Well, have you ever thought about, or maybe somebody has already suggested this to you, that you could do something, do a performance around the book where you could tell stories and sing the songs that you've chosen here to illustrate parts of their, you know, to illustrate your actual narrative? You could actually perform this. It could become a show.
Well, yes, people have suggested that, and I am mindful of it, and would love to create something like that. So,
Add one more thing to your list of to-dos.
Yes, yes. It'd be a lot of fun.
Right. Not as if you have nothing else to do, because I know, and before, you know, I know you have to go fairly soon, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but you have established a museum of the American Songbook in Carmel, Indiana, and I assume that keeps you fairly busy.
Yes, it does. I'm the artistic director of the Palladium in Carmel, Indiana, which is a wonderful performing arts center, state-of-the-art, a $180 million dream. And I also created the Feinstein Initiative there, which is to keep American popular music alive, and we have annual competitions for high school students that has been growing in leaps and bounds. It's now national with regionals every year. And so I'm meeting all these young kids that care about the Great American Songbook. So everything I do these days, in one way or another, leads back to this classic music.
Well, I think it's not only is it a wonderful thing to be doing, but it is really, you know, it's rewarding as someone who listens to the music and enjoys hearing you sing. It's great. And I thought this book was amazingly wonderful. And incredibly, I mean, you overcame one of the difficulties in writing a personal book is to, you have to avoid sentimentality and kind of going too deeply into your own personal view of things, I think. And, you wrote this as a personal story. It's about you and the Gershwins, but it really is about the Gershwins. And I think you did a great job of telling their story.
Oh, well, I very much appreciate that, David. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for taking the time and really enjoyed it. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. We've been talking about the book The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs by Michael Feinstein.